Green Mars, Cassette 2.
After that, he found it extremely hard to concentrate. He felt as if he was always at a remove from things, tripped by the size of the things, but happy too that it wasn't absolutely overwhelming as his first walk out had been. That had trips out. Nergal was shocked by the idea, having never been more than a walk away from Zygote. But Hiroko insisted. He was 7 years old, she said, and about to become a man. Time he saw a bit of the surface world. A few weeks later, Coyote dropped by, and when he left again, Nergal was with him, seated in the co-pilot's seat of his boulder car and goggling out the low windshield at the purple arch of evening sky. Coyote turned the car around to give him a view of the great glowing pink wall of the polar cap, which arced across the horizon like an enormous rising moon. "It's hard to believe something that big could ever melt," Nergal said. "It will take a while." They drove north at a sedate pace. The boulder car was stealthed, covered by a hollowed-out rock shell that was thermally regulated to stay the same temperature as its surroundings, and it had a no-track device on the front axle to read the terrain and pass the information to the back axle, where scraper shapers plowed their wheel tracks, returning the sand and rock to whatever shape they had had before their passing, so they could not race along. For a long time they traveled in silence, though Coyote's silence was not the same as Simon's had been. He hummed, he muttered, he talked in a low sing-song voice to his AI, in a language that sounded like English, but was not comprehensible. Nergal tried to concentrate on the limited view out the window, feeling awkward and shy. The region around the South Polar Cap was a series of broad, flat terraces, and they descended from one to the next by routes that seemed programmed into the car, down terrace after terrace, until it seemed the polar cap must be sitting on a kind of huge pedestal. Nergal stared into the dark, impressed by the size of the things, but happy too that it wasn't absolutely overwhelming as his first walk out had been. That had happened a long time ago, but he could still remember the staggering astonishment of it perfectly. This was not like that. "It doesn't seem as big as I thought it would," he said. "I guess it's the curvature of the land, it being such a small planet and all." As the lectern said, "The horizon isn't any farther away than one side of Zygote to the other." "Uh-huh," Coyote said, giving him a look. "You better not let Big Man hear you say such a thing. He kick your ass for that." Then, "Who's your father, boy?" "I don't know. Hiroko is my mother," Coyote snorted. "Hiroko takes the matriarchy too far, if you ask me." "Have you told her that?" "You bet I have, but Hiroko only listens to me when I say things she wants to hear," he cackled. "Same as with everyone, right?" Nergal nodded, a grin splitting his attempt to be impassive. "You want to find out who your father is?" "Sure." Actually, he wasn't sure. The concept of father meant little to him, and he was afraid it would turn out to be Simon. Peter was like an older brother to him, after all. "They've got the equipment in Vishniak. We can try there if you want."
Coyote shook his head.
"Hiroko is so strange. When I met her, you would never have guessed it would come to this. Of course, we were young then, almost as young as you are, though you will find that hard to credit."
Which was true.
"When I met her, she was just a young Echo engineering student, smart as a whip and sexy as a cat. None of this mother goddess of the world stuff. But by and by, she started to read books that were not her technical manuals, and it went on, and by the time she got to Mars, she was crazy. Before, actually, which is lucky for me, as that is why I'm here. But Hiroko, oh my! She was convinced that all human history had gone wrong at the start. At the dawn of civilization, she would say to me very seriously, there was Crete and Sumeria and Crete. Had a peaceful trading culture run by women and filled with art and beauty. A utopia, in fact, where the men were acrobats who jumped bulls all day and women all night and got the women pregnant and worshipped them, and everyone was happy. It sounds good, except for the bulls. While Sumeria, on the other hand, was ruled by men who invented war and conquered everything in sight and started all the slave empires that have come since. And no one knew, Hiroko said, what might have happened if these two civilizations had had a chance to contest the rule of the world, because a volcano blew Crete to kingdom come, and the world passed into Sumeria's hands and has never left it to this day. If only that volcano had been in Sumeria, she used to tell me, everything would be different, and maybe it's true. Because history could hardly get any blacker than it has been. Nergal was surprised at this characterization. But now, he ventured, we're starting again. That's right, boy. We are the primitives of an unknown civilization, living in our own little techno-Minoan matriarchy. Ha! I like it fine myself. Seems to me the power that our women have taken on was never that interesting to begin with. Power is one half of the yoke. Don't you remember that from the stuff I made you kids read? Master and slave wear the yoke together. Anarchy is the only true freedom. So, well, whatever women do, it seems to go against them. If they're men's cows, then they work till they drop. But if they're our queens and goddesses, then they only work the harder, because they still have to do the cow work and then the paperwork, too. No way. Just be thankful you're a man and as free as the sky. It was a peculiar way to think of things, Nergal thought. But clearly it was one way to deal with the fact of Jackie's beauty, of her immense power over his mind. And so Nergal ducked low in his seat and stared out the window at the white stars in the black, thinking, free as the sky, free as the sky. It was LS-4, 2 March the 22nd, M-year 32, and the southern days were getting shorter. Coyote drove their car hard every night over intricate and invisible paths through terrain that got more and more rugged the farther they got from the polar cap. They stopped to rest during the daylight and drove the rest of the time. Nergal tried to stay awake, but inevitably slept through part of every drive and through part of every day's stop as well, until he became thoroughly confused in both time and space. But when he was awake, he was almost always looking out the window at the ever-changing surface of Mars. He couldn't get enough of it. In the layered terrain, there was an infinite array of patterns. The stratified stacks of sand fluted by the wind until each dune was cut like a bird's wing. When the layered terrain finally ran out onto exposed bedrock, the laminate dunes became individual sand islands scattered over a jumbled plain of outcroppings and clusters of rock. It was red rock everywhere he looked. Rock sized from gravel to immense boulders that sat like buildings on the land. The sand islands were tucked into every dip and hollow in this rockscape, and they also clustered around the feet of big knots of boulders and on the lee sides of low scarps and in the interiors of craters. And there were craters everywhere. They first appeared as two bumps rolling over the skysill, which quickly proved to be the connected outer points of a low ridge. They passed scores of these flat-topped hills, some steep and sharp, others low and nearly buried, still others with their rims broken by smaller later impacts, so that one could see right into the sand drifts filling them. One night, just before dawn, Coyote stopped the car. Something wrong? No, we've reached Ray's lookout, and I want you to see it. Sun'll be up in an hour. So they sat in the pilot's seats and watched the dawn. How old are you, boy? 7. What's that, 13 Earth years? 14? I guess. Wow, you're already taller than me. Uh-huh. Nergal refrained from pointing out that this didn't imply any great height. How old are you?
109. Ah! You best shut your eyes or they'll pop out of your head. Don't you look at me like that. I was old the day I was born, and I'll be young the day I die.
They drowsed as the sky on the eastern skyline turned a deep purply blue. Coyote hummed a little tune to himself, sounding as if he had eaten a tab of Omegendorf, as he often did in the evenings at Zygote. Gradually it became clear that the skysill was very far away and also very high. Nergal had never seen land so far away, and it seemed to curve around them as well, a black curving wall that lay an immense distance off over a black rocky plain.
"Hey, Coyote!" he exclaimed. "What is this?"
"Ha!" Coyote said, sounding deeply satisfied.
The sky lightened, and the sun suddenly cracked the upper edge of the distant wall, blasting Nergal's vision for a while. But as the sun rose, the shadows on the huge semicircular cliff gave way in wedges of light that revealed sharp, ragged embayments, scalloping the larger curve of the wall, which was so big that Nergal simply gasped, his nose pressed right against the windshield. It was almost frightening, it was so big.
"Coyote, what is it?"
Coyote let out one of his alarming laughs, the animal cackle filling the car.
"So you see, it isn't such a small world after all, eh, boy? This is the floor of Promethei Basin. It's an impact basin, one of the biggest on Mars, almost as big as our gyre, but it hit down here near the South Pole, so about half of its rim has since been buried under the polar cap and the layered terrain. The other half is this curved escarpment here."
He waved a hand expansively.
"Kind of like a super big caldera, but only half there, so you can drive right into it. This little rise is the best place I know for seeing it."
He called up a map of the region and pointed.
"We're on the apron of this little crater here, VT, and looking northwest. The cliff is Promethei Rupes there. It's about a kilometer high. Of course, the Echis Cliff is 3 kilometers high, and the Olympus Mons Cliff is 6 kilometers high. Do you hear that, Mr. Small Planet? But this baby will have to do for this morning."
The sun rose higher, illuminating the great curve of the cliff from above. It was deeply cut by ravines and smaller craters.
"Prometheus Sanctuary is in the side of that big indentation there," Coyote said, and pointed to the left side of the curve. "Crater WJ.
As they waded through the long day, Nergal looked at the gigantic cliff almost continuously, and each time it looked different as the shadows shortened and shifted, revealing new features and obscuring others. It would have taken years of looking to see it all, and he found he couldn't overcome the feeling that the wall was unnaturally or even impossibly huge. Coyote was right. The tight horizons had fooled him. He hadn't imagined the world could be so big. That night they drove into Crater WJ, one of the biggest embayments in the giant wall, and then they reached the curving cliff of Promethei Rupes. The cliff towered over them like the vertical side of the universe itself. The polar cap was nothing compared to this rock mass, which meant that the Olympus Mons cliff that Coyote had mentioned would have to be... He didn't know how to think it. Down at the foot of the cliff, at a spot where unbroken rock dropped almost vertically into flat sand, there was a recessed locked door. Inside was the sanctuary called Prometheus, a collection of wide chambers stacked like the rooms of a bamboo house, with incurving filtered windows overlooking Crater WJ and the larger basin beyond. The inhabitants of the sanctuary spoke French, and so did Coyote when talking to them. They were not as old as Coyote or the other Issei, but they were pretty old and of Terran height, which meant they mostly looked up to Nergal while speaking very hospitably to him in fluent but accented English.
"So you are Nergal? Enchanté. We have heard of you. We are happy to meet you,"
A group of them showed him around while Coyote did other things. Their sanctuary was very unlike Zygote. It was, to put it plainly, nothing but rooms. There were several large ones stacked by the wall, with smaller ones at the back of these. Three of the window rooms were greenhouses, and all the rooms throughout the refuge were kept very warm and filled with plants and wall hangings and statuary and fountains. To Nergal it seemed confining and much too hot and utterly fascinating. But they only stayed a day, and then they drove Coyote's car into a big elevator and sat in it for an hour. When Coyote drove out the opposite door, they were on top of the rugged plateau that lay behind Promethei Rupees. And here Nergal was once again shocked. When they had been down at Ray's lookout, the great cliff had formed a limit to what they could see, and he had been able to comprehend it. But on top of the cliff, looking back down, the distances were so great that Nergal couldn't grasp what he saw. It was nothing but a blurry, vertiginous mass of blobs and patches of color. White, purple, brown, tan, rust, white. It made him queasy. "Storm coming in," Coyote said, and suddenly Nergal saw that the colors above them were a fleet of tall, solid clouds sailing through a violet sky with the sun well to the west, the clouds whitish above and infinitely lobed, but dark gray on their bottoms. These cloud bottoms were closer to their heads than the ground of the basin, and they were level, as if rolling over a transparent floor. The world below was nothing so even, mottled tan and chocolate. Ah, those were the shadows of the clouds, visibly moving. And that white crescent out in the middle of things was the polar cap. They could see all the way home. Recognizing the ice gave him the final bit of perspective needed to make sense of things, and the blobs of color stabilized into a bumpy, uneven, ringed landscape modeled by moving cloud shadows. This dizzying act of cognition had only taken Nergal a few seconds, but when he finished, he saw that Coyote was watching him with a big grin. "Just how far can we see, Coyote? How many kilometers?" Coyote only cackled. "Ask big man, boy, or figure it out for yourself. What, 300K? Something like that. A hop and a jump for the big one. 1,000 empires for the little ones." "I want to run it." "I'm sure you do. Oh, look, look, there. From the clouds over the ice cap. Lightning, see it? Those little flickers are lightning." And there they were, bright threads of light appearing and disappearing soundlessly, one or two every few seconds, connecting black clouds with white ground. He was seeing lightning at last with his own eyes, the white world sparkling into the green, jolting it. "There's nothing like a big storm," Coyote was saying. "Nothing like it. Oh, to be out in the wind. We made that storm, boy. Although I think I could make an even bigger one." But a bigger one was beyond Nergal's ability to imagine. What lay below them was cosmically vast, electric, shot with color, windy with spaciousness. He was actually a bit relieved when Coyote turned their car around and drove off, and the blurry view disappeared, the edge of the cliff becoming a new skysill behind them. "Just what is lightning again?"
"Well, lightning... shit. I must confess that lightning is one of the phenomena in this world that I cannot hold the explanation for in my head. People have told me, but it always slips away. Electricity, of course. Something about electrons or ions, positive and negative. Charges building up in thunderheads, discharging to the ground, or both up and down at once, I seem to recall. Who knows? Kaboom! That's lightning, eh?"
The white world and the green, rubbing together, snapping with the friction. Of course. There were several sanctuaries on the plateau north of Promethei Rupees, some hidden in escarpment walls and crater rims, like Nadia's tunneling project outside Zygote, but others simply sitting in craters under clear tent domes, there for any sky police to see. The first time Coyote drove up to the rim of one of these and they looked down through the clear tent dome onto a village under the stars, Nergal had been once again amazed, though it was amazement of a lesser order than that engendered by the landscape. Buildings like the school and the bathhouse and the kitchen, trees, greenhouses, it was all basically familiar. But how could they get away with it out in the open like this? It was disconcerting. And so full of people, of strangers. Nergal had known in theory that there were a lot of people in the southern sanctuaries, 5,000 as they said, all defeated rebels of the 2061 war. But it was something else again to meet so many of them so fast and see that it was really true. And staying in the unhidden settlements made him extremely nervous. "How can they do it?" he asked Coyote. "Why aren't they arrested and taken away?" "You got me, boy. It's possible they could be, but they haven't been yet, and so they don't think it's worth the trouble to hide. You know, it takes a tremendous effort to hide. You gotta do all that thermal disposal engineering and electronic hardening, and you gotta keep out of sight all the time. It's a pain in the ass. And some people down here just don't want to do it. They call themselves the Demimonde. They have plans for if they're ever investigated or invaded. Most of them have escape tunnels like ours, and some even have some weapons stashed away. But they figure that if they're out on the surface, there's no reason to be checked out in the first place. The folks in Christianopolis just told the UN straight out that they came down here to get out of the net. But I agree with Hiroko on this one, that some of us have to be a little more careful than that. The UN is out to get the first 100, if you ask me, and its family, too, unfortunately for you kids. Anyway, now the resistance includes the underground and the Demimonde, and having the open towns is a big help to the hidden sanctuaries, so I'm glad they're here. At this point, we depend on them. Coyote was welcomed effusively in this town, as he was everywhere, whether the settlement was hidden or exposed. He settled into a corner of a big garage on the crater rim and conducted a continuous, brisk exchange of goods, including seed stocks, software, light bulbs, spare parts, and small machines. These he gave out after long consultations with their hosts in bargaining sessions that Nergal couldn't understand. And then, after a brief tour of the crater floor, where the village looked surprisingly like zygote under a brilliant purple dome, they were off again. On the drives between sanctuaries, Coyote didn't explain his bargaining sessions very effectively. "I'm saving these people from their own ridiculous notion of economics, that's what I'm doing. A gift economy is all very well, but it isn't organized enough for our situation. There are critical items that everyone has to have, so people have to give, which is a contradiction, right? So I'm trying to work out a rational system. Actually, Vlad and Marina are working it out, and I'm trying to implement it, which means I get all the grief." "And this system?" "Well, it's a sort of two-track thing, where they can still give all they want, but the necessities are given values and distributed properly. And good God, you wouldn't believe some of the arguments I get in. People can be such fools. I try to make sure it all adds up to a stable ecology like one of Hiroko's systems, with every sanctuary filling its niche and providing its specialty. And what do I get for it? Abuse, that's what I get. Radical abuse. I try to stop potlatching and they call me a robber baron. I try to stop hoarding and they call me a fascist. The fools. What are they gonna do when none of them are self-sufficient and half of them are crazy paranoid?" He sighed theatrically. "So anyway, we're making progress. Christianopolis makes light bulbs, and Moss Hyde grows new kinds of plants, as you saw, and Bogdanov Vishniak makes everything big and difficult, like reactor rods and stealth vehicles and most of the big robots. And your zygote makes scientific instrumentation and so on. And I spread them around." "Are you the only one doing that?" "Almost.
They're mostly self-sufficient, actually, except for these few criticalities. They all got programs and seeds. That's the basic necessities. And besides, it's important that not too many people know where all the hidden sanctuaries are.
Nergal digested the implications of this as they drove through the night. Coyote went on about the hydrogen peroxide standard and the nitrogen standard, a new system of Vlad and marinas, and Nergal did his best to follow, but found it hard going, either because the concepts were difficult, or else because Coyote spent most of his explanations fulminating over the difficulties he encountered in certain sanctuaries. Nergal decided to ask Sax or Nadia about it when he got home and stopped listening. The land they were crossing now was dominated by crater rings, the newer ones overlapping and even burying older ones.
"This is called saturation cratering. Very ancient ground."
A lot of the craters had no raised rims at all, but were simply shallow, flat-bottomed round holes in the ground.
"What happened to the rims?"
"Worn away."
"By what?"
"Anne says ice and wind. She says as much as a kilometer was stripped off the southern highlands over time."
"That would take away everything."
"But then more came back. This is old land."
In between craters, the land was covered with loose rock, and it was unbelievably uneven. There were dips, rises, hollows, knolls, trenches, grabens, uplifts, hills and dales, never even a moment's flatness, except on crater rims and occasional low ridges, both of which Coyote used as roads when he could. But the track he followed over this lumpy landscape was still torturous, and Nergal couldn't believe it was memorized. He said as much, and Coyote laughed.
"What do you mean, memorized? We're lost!"
But not really, or not for long. A mohole plume appeared over the horizon, and Coyote drove for it.
"Knew it all along," he muttered. "This is Vishniac Mohole. It's a vertical shaft a kilometer across, dug straight down into the bedrock. There were four moholes started around the 75-degree latitude line, and two of them are no longer occupied, even by robots. Vishniac is one of the two, and it's been taken over by a bunch of Bogdanovists who live down inside it."
He laughed.
"It's a wonderful idea, because they can dig into the side wall along the road to the bottom, and down there they can put out as much heat as they want, and no one can tell that it's not just more mohole outgassing. So they can build anything they like, even process uranium for reactor fuel rods. It's an entire little industrial city now. Also one of my favorite places. Very big on partying."
He drove them into one of the many small trenches cutting the land, then braked and tapped at his screen, and a big rock swung out from the side of the trench, revealing a black tunnel. Coyote drove into the tunnel, and the rock door closed behind them. Nergal had thought he was beyond surprise at this point, but he watched round-eyed as they drove down the tunnel, its rough rock walls just outside the edges of the boulder car. It seemed to go on forever.
"They've dug a number of approach tunnels so that the mohole itself can look completely unvisited. We have about 20 kilometers to go."
Eventually, Coyote turned off the headlights. Their car rolled out into the dim eggplant black of night. They were on a steep road, apparently spiraling down the wall of the mohole. Their instrument panel lights were like tiny lanterns, and looking through his reflected image, Nergal could see that the road was 4 or 5 times as wide as the car. The full extent of the mohole itself was impossible to see, but by the curve of the road he could tell that it was immense.
"Are you sure we're turning at the right speed?"
he said anxiously.
"I'm trusting the automatic pilot," Coyote said, irritated. "It's bad luck to discuss it."
The car rolled down the road. After more than an hour's descent, there was a beep from the instrument panel, and the car turned into the curving wall of rock to their left. And there was a garage tube clanking against their outer lock door. Inside the garage, a group of 20 or so people greeted them and took them past a line of tall rooms to a cavern-like chamber. The rooms that the Bogdanovists had excavated into the side of the mohole were big, much bigger than those at Prometheus. The back rooms were 10 meters high as a rule, and in some cases 200 meters deep. And the main cavern rivaled Zygote itself, with big windows facing out onto the hole. Looking sideways through the window, Nergal saw that the glass seen from the outside looked like the rock face. The filtered coatings must have been clever indeed, because as the morning arrived, its light poured in very brightly. The window's view was limited to the far wall of the mohole and a gibbous patch of sky above, but they gave the rooms a wonderful sense of spaciousness and light, a feeling of being under the sky that Zygote couldn't match. Through that first day, Nergal was taken in hand by a small, dark-skinned man named Hilaly, who led him through the rooms and interrupted people at their work to introduce him. People were friendly.
"You must be one of Hiroko's kids, eh? Oh, you're Nergal. Very nice to meet you. Hey, John, Coyote's here. Party tonight."
And they showed him what they were doing, leading him back into smaller rooms behind the ones fronting the mohole, where there were farms under bright light and manufactories that seemed to extend back into the rock forever. And all of it very warm, as in a bathhouse, so that Nergal was constantly sweating.
"Where did you put all the excavated rock?"
he asked Hilaly, for one of the convenient things about cutting a dome under the polar cap, Hiroko had said, was that the excavated dry ice had simply been gassed off.
"It's lining the road near the bottom of the mohole," Hilaly told him, pleased at the question.
He seemed pleased with all Nergal's questions, as did everyone else. People in Vishniac seemed happy in general, a rowdy crowd who always partied to celebrate Coyote's arrival. One excuse among many, Nergal gathered. Hilaly took a call on the wrist from Coyote and led Nergal into a lab where they took a bit of skin from his finger. Then they made their way slowly back to the big cavern and joined the crowd lining up by the kitchen windows at the back. After eating a big spicy meal of beans and potatoes, they began to party in the cavern room. A huge, undisciplined steel drum band, with a fluctuating membership, played rhythmic staccato melodies, and people danced to them for hours, pausing from time to time to drink an atrocious liquor called Kava Java, or join a variety of games on one side of the room. After trying the Kava Java and swallowing a tab of a Megendorf given to him by Coyote, Nergal ran in place while playing a bass drum with the band, then sat on top of a small grassy mound in the center of the chamber, feeling too drunk to stand. Coyote had been drinking steadily but had no such problem. He was dancing wildly, hopping high off his toes and laughing.
"You'll never know the joy of your own G, boy," he shouted at Nergal. "You'll never know!"
People came by and introduced themselves, sometimes asking Nergal to exhibit his warming touch. A group of girls his age put his hands to their cheeks, which they had chilled with their drinks, and when he warmed them up, they laughed round-eyed and invited him to warm other parts of them. He got up and danced with them instead, feeling loose and dizzy, running in little circles to discharge some of the energy in him. When he returned to the knoll, buzzing, Coyote came weaving over and sat heavily beside him.
"So fine to dance in this G. I never get over it."
He regarded Nergal with a cross-eyed glare, his gray dreadlocks falling all over his head, and Nergal noticed again that his face seemed to have cracked somehow, perhaps been broken at the jaw, so that one side was broader than the other. Something like that. Nergal gulped at the sight. Coyote took him by the shoulder and shook him hard.
"It seems that I am your father, boy," he exclaimed. "You're kidding."
An electric flush ran down Nergal's spine and out his face as the two of them stared at each other, and he marveled at how the white world could shock the green one so thoroughly, like lightning pulsing through flesh. They clutched each other.
"I am not kidding," Coyote said.
They stared at each other.
"No wonder you're so smart,"
Coyote said, and laughed hilariously.
"Ah, ha, 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 wow! I hope it's okay with you."
"Sure," Nergal said, grinning, but uncomfortable. He didn't know Coyote well, and the concept of father was even vaguer to him than that of mother, so he wasn't really sure what he felt. Genetic inheritance, sure, but what was that? They all got their genes somewhere, and the genes of ectogenes were transgenic anyway, or so they said. But Coyote, though he cursed Hiroko in 100 different ways, seemed to be pleased.
"That vixen, that tyrant! Matriarchy my ass! She's crazy! It amazes me the things she does. Although this has a certain justice to it, yes, it does, because Hiroko and I were an item back in the dawn of time when we were young in England. That's the reason I'm here on Mars at all, a stowaway in her closet my whole fucking life long." He laughed and clapped Nergal on the shoulder again. "Well, boy, you'll know better how you like the idea later on."
He went back out to dance, leaving Nergal to think it over. Watching Coyote's gyrations, Nergal could only shake his head. He didn't know what to think, and at the moment thinking anything at all was remarkably difficult. Better to dance or seek out the baths. But they had no public baths. He ran around in circles on the dance floor, making his running a kind of dance, and later he returned to the same mound, and a group of the locals gathered around him and Coyote.
"Like being the father of the Dalai Lama, eh? Don't you get a name for that?" "To hell with you, man! Like I was saying, Anne says they stopped digging these 75-degree moleholes because the lithosphere is thinner down here."
Coyote nodded portentously.
"I want to go to one of the decommissioned moles and start up its robots again and see if they dig down far enough to start a volcano."
Everyone laughed, but one woman shook her head. "If you do that, they'll come down here to check it out. If you're going to do it, you should go north and hit one of the 60-degree moleholes. They're decommissioned, too."
"But the lithosphere up there is thicker," Ann says.
"Sure, but the moleholes are deeper, too." Coyote said. And the conversation moved on to more serious matters, mostly the inevitable topics of shortages and developments in the north. But at the end of that week, when they left Vishniac by way of a different and longer tunnel, they headed north, and all Coyote's previous plans had been thrown out the window.
"That's the story of my life, boy."
On the fifth night of driving over the jumbled highlands of the south, Coyote slowed the rover and circled the edge of a big old crater, subdued almost to the level of the surrounding plain. From a defile in the ancient rim, one could see that the sandy crater floor was marred by a giant round black hole. This, apparently, was what a molehole looked like from the surface. A plume of thin frost stood in the air a few hundred meters over the hole, appearing from nothing, like a magician's trick. The edge of the molehole was beveled so that there was a band of concrete funneling down at about a 45-degree angle. It was hard to say how big this coping band was, because the molehole made it seem like no more than a strip. There was a high-wire fence at its outer edge. Coyote said, staring out the windshield. He backed up in the defile and parked, then slipped into a walker.
"Back soon,"
he said, and hopped into the lock. It was a long, anxious night for Nergal. He barely slept and was in an intensifying agony of worry the next morning when he saw Coyote appear outside the Boulder car lock just before 7 a.m. when the sun was about to rise. He was ready to complain about the length of this disappearance, but when Coyote got inside and got his helmet off, it was obvious he was in a foul temper. While they sat out the day, he tapped away at his AI in an absorbed conference, cursing vilely, oblivious to his hungry young charge. Nergal went ahead and heated meals for them both, and then napped uneasily and woke when the rover jerked forward.
"I'm going to try going in through the gate,"
Coyote said.
"That's quite the security they have on that hole. One more night should see it either way."
He circled the crater and parked on the far rim, and at dusk once again left on foot. Again, he was gone all night, and again Nergal found it very difficult to sleep. He wondered what he was supposed to do if Coyote didn't return. And indeed, he was not back by dawn. The day that followed was the longest of Nergal's life without a question, and at the end of it, he had no idea what he was going to do. Try to rescue Coyote? Try to drive back to Zygote or Vishniac? Go down to the Mo-hole and give himself up to whatever mysterious security system had eaten up Coyote? All seemed impossible. But an hour after sunset, Coyote tapped the car with his tick-tick-tick, and then he was inside, his face a furious mask. He drank a liter of water, and then most of another, and blew out his lips in disgust. "Let's get the fuck out of here," he said. After a couple of hours of silent driving, Nergal thought to change the subject, or at least enlarge it, and he said, "Coyote, how long do you think we will have to stay hidden?"
"Don't call me Coyote! I'm not Coyote! Coyote is out there in the back of the hills breathing the air already and doing what he wants, the bastard! Me, my name is Desmond. You call me Desmond, understand?"
"Okay," Nergal said, afraid.
"As for how long we will have to stay hiding, I think it will be forever."
They drove back south to Rayleigh Mo-hole, where Coyote, he didn't seem to be a Desmond, had thought to go in the first place. This Mo-hole was truly abandoned, an unlit hole in the highlands, its thermal plume standing over it like the ghost of a monument. They could drive right into the empty sand-covered parking lot and garage at its rim, between a small fleet of robot vehicles shrouded by tarpaulins and sand drifts.
"This is more like it," Coyote muttered. "Here, we've got to take a look down inside it. Come on, get into your walker."
It was strange to be out in the wind, standing on the rim of such an enormous gap in things. They looked over a chest-high wall and saw the beveled concrete band that rimmed the hole, dropping at an angle for about 200 meters. In order to see down the shaft proper, they had to walk about a kilometer down a curving road cut into the concrete band. There they could stop at last and look over the road's edge down into blackness. Coyote stood right on the edge, which made Nergal nervous. He got on his hands and knees to look over. No sign of a bottom. They might as well have been looking into the center of the planet.
20 kilometers, Coyote said over the intercom.
He held a hand out over the edge, and Nergal did too. He could feel the updraft.
"Okay, let's see if we can get the robots going."
And they hiked back up the road. Coyote had spent many of their daytime hours studying old programs on his AI, and now, with the hydrogen peroxide from their trailer pumped into two of the robot behemoths in the parking lot, he plugged into their control panels and went at it. When he was done, he was satisfied they would perform as required at the bottom of the mo-hole, and they watched the two, with wheels 4 times as tall as Coyote's car, roll off down the curving road.
"All right," Coyote said, cheering up again. "They'll use their solar panel power to process their own peroxide explosives and their own fuel as well, and go at it slow and steady until maybe they hit something hot. We just may have started a volcano."
"Is that good?" Coyote laughed wildly.
"I don't know, but no one's ever done it before, so it has that at least to recommend it."
This ends side one of cassette 2. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.